this is Louisa Beal with Radio Tacoma, and I am here with one, two, three, four, five people from Extinction Rebellion. And I know a little bit, but not very much. So I'm going to let them explain who they are and what they're doing.
Well, thanks for the introduction. I'm Jonathan Logan. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm part of the Extinction Rebellion America National Support Team. And some of the folks that we have on here with us today are taking different roles inside Extinction Rebellion. So maybe they could tell you about themselves. Adelaide, did you want to maybe go next?
Sure. Yeah, my name's Adelaide Beeman-White. I also live in Portland, Oregon, and I am a mass mobilizer with Extinction Rebellion America. So my job is basically to spread the word about our movement, recruit new members, and organize events.
And then I'm Donald Zepeda. I'm also a mass mobilizer here in Seattle, Washington, and same responsibilities. Do outreach, organize events, facilitate meetings, help start chapters. We're trying to start as many chapters as possible across the country, and help them out, you know, through their first months, get them on their feet so they can keep going after, you know, after that first month.
I am Cameron Jacobson. I am a volunteer / event coordinator with Extinction Rebellion. I have helped organize a few traffic blocks in the past several months, and we will continue to do these until we have enough people interested to take our message to DC.
And I'm Isaac. I've been organizing events with Cameron. I'll also be mobilizing soon. And I've been helping out with the media, PR, and handbook teams in the meantime.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all for being here. And I suppose my question, well, I have several questions, but one of the first ones is, how did you come to be doing what you are?
My story is kind of circuitous, but I started out, I grew up in New York, upstate New York, and when I was a child, there was a lot of stuff going on about Vietnam War. There was a lot of things going on about the ecology movement, as they called it back then. And then when I was in high school, I built my first solar panel and went on to get an undergraduate degree in environmental studies and then to work for a solar company. And Reagan killed the solar tax credits. And so the company went bankrupt. And then I went to law school to do environmental law to fight for the environment. And when I got out of school, the cost of loans was so high and my school loans were so gigantic and nobody but Exxon was hiring. So I wasn't going to go work for Exxon. So I went off and did some other things and practiced law for a while. And then over the years got more and more interested in climate. But when I saw the IPCC and saw Al Gore, you know, working as vice president, I thought, they've got this. This is going to be great. It's all going to be taken care of. Smart people have the ball and they'll take care of it. And then every once in a while, I would sort of gopher up and look around at the environmental movement and realize maybe it needed more love and help and step in, step out. But a couple of years ago, it became clear to me that we weren't really solving the problem, that things were accelerating and getting worse. And so I did some work, some consulting work for a solar company, and got deeper back into it. And it just became clear to me that we were in a near apocalyptic kind of situation. We're heading for a complete climate collapse right now. And it's a runaway train. And everyone seems to be asleep at the wheel. And those in government and in business and in banking and in energy seem to really not grasp the deep gravity of the science of what's going on. So with my science background, I was like, well, the science is clear. It's not a question of, you know, is it real or not? It's like, this is science. It's geophysics. It's, you know, it's atmospheric chemistry. It's clear. And so we have a physics problem and that we should address immediately. And so I heard about Extinction Rebellion. I started to get involved with it a little bit. And then sooner or later, I was like, I got to go all in. So That's how I got involved here early this year, late last year, just all in. So Adelaide?
Yeah. So I recently graduated from the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma. And I double majored in history and environmental policy. I thought that I'd been concerned about climate change since about my second year in high school, but I was actually reading through my middle school diary recently, and I was apparently worried about climate change back then. So I guess I kind of was worried and then forgot about it, then started worrying again. And I became a very fanatical devotee of recycling and composting. And I thought, if everybody just recycles everything, that will save the world. You know, I became that person who lectures, or like stands over the trash can and like, no, that's recyclable, that goes there, and started annoying everybody. And I eventually came to the realization that the only outcome that my fanatical recycling was having was making people not like me. It was not having really any impact on climate change. No matter how much I recycled and how much I lectured people about what was recyclable and what wasn't, the problem was still getting worse. So I realized in the beginning of college that I really had to kick into a higher gear. So I took place in political campaigns and door knocking and all of these kinds of things, you know, what have you. And it eventually kind of snowballed. It was sort of inevitable that I would end up here. But the reason that I'm part of all of this is because I'm afraid. This is something that threatens to kill all of humanity and everything else besides. And I personally don't want to die, and I don't want my loved ones to die, and I don't want everybody else to die too. But I would be lying if I were to say that my deepest motivations for being here are entirely selfish. I don't want to die. And I'm scared. And I think that this is the best way of preserving not only my own life, but the lives of everybody else.
Thank you. Hey. Wow.
So my story is, I grew up, went to church, and the sermon, the message really spoke to me, you know, help the poor. This is what Jesus wants us to do. This is what we are supposed to do while we're here. When I went to college, I hopped around in some majors, eventually wound up with international relations. It was a mix of local science, history, geography, smooshed together into a comprehensive whole. And so at that point in my life, I didn't think I could solve all poverty, but I thought I could help where it was worst. I took populated a graph of, population versus experienced well-being, and then found the place that took up the most area was Tanzania. So I figured I'd try and help with economic development there. So I studied Tanzania's history, geography, economy, et cetera. As I was doing this, I came across the unfortunate fact that without significant changes in how we're addressing climate change, there will be development backslides in this country and in other countries. And the emissions are coming from North America, Europe, and Asia primarily. And so, I'm in one of those places. I figured if I want these countries to stand a chance at growing, we need to get this issue under control. So I need to pivot to climate change. So I co-founded a 350.org affiliate back in Lansing, Michigan, where I was. That has civil disobedience in the toolkit, but it tends to be more conventional campaigning. But as I was studying this issue, getting more and more into it, I found, mass civil disobedience is what we need to actually get the kind of change that we need. So came out to Washington to help with the Valve Turner movement a bit, and saw Extinction Rebellion in the UK get some pretty good wins in 2019. Saw Extinction Rebellion here in the US. They proposed a national plan that seemed really inspiring to me just this year, and I wanted to plug in and get involved. And so that's what brought me here.
Wow. Thank you.
I just want to put a quick shout out to Adelaide. Composting. I am also a huge, huge advocate for composting. According to a 2016 report by the EPA, 12% of all methane emissions from North America were from landfills, and that's all food waste. As far as my personal story, I grew up thinking that climate change would kind of just be resolved by, government, technology. Didn't happen.
I went to college for software development, became an engineer. I'm very much mind focused towards optimization, and beyond changing my own habits towards removing animal products from my diet, biking everywhere, like I can only do so much. The next step for me was getting directly into activism, getting on the streets. I met Isaac on the streets doing animal rights activism. I figured the best way for me to work on emissions was to have that conversation. And then I learned about Extinction Rebellion about a year into my animal rights activism, and have been active with them since then, getting more and more involved.
And for myself, about a few years ago, I realized that by purchasing animal products, I was contributing to the animal holocaust. So I immediately changed that, became vegan, became an animal rights activist, and was on the streets all the time talking to folks about that. And over time, the conversations eventually added in about how much that affected the climate, the production of animal products, and how leaving them out of your lifestyle can benefit the climate immensely. And so I became more aware of the climate in general, the climate emergency, what the world is going to look like very soon if we don't do something about it. So already being adapted to the streets, I love street activism. I came upon XR and now I'm here.
Well, those are some great stories. I really appreciate you sharing your journeys like that. Another question that I have is, what makes you different from some of these other environmental organizations, say like 350?
Well, one of the big things that makes us different is that we focus on, our central focus is what we call nonviolent direct action. So you can see a lot of examples of this in history. This is the history major in me coming through. Gandhi's rebellion against English rule in India, that was nonviolent direct action. The suffragettes in America engaged in nonviolent direct action. Don't be confused, the suffragettes in England were violent. So if you want examples from the suffragettes, don't look at the English ones, but look at the American suffragettes. They engaged in nonviolent direct action. Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., they're all people who engaged in nonviolent direct action, and that is the core of our movement. There are other movements that involve nonviolent direct actions, but we don't spend time trying to get bills passed or trying to work with politics. I mean, if a politician were to come in and say, hey, you know, we want to help you further Extinction Rebellion's goals, then we'd work with them. But our main focus isn't to get a specific piece of legislation passed. Our main focus is to cause disruption to get our four demands passed. And I'll let somebody else speak on the four demands.
That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. I think I want to just dovetail a little bit on what Adelaide said, which is, you know, part of our strategic differentiator is that, I think I attended my first Earth Day back in the late 70s, right, and early 80s. And, I've done the marches, I've done the protests, I've done the sit-ins, I've done letter writing, I've done call centers, you know, politician call centers. I've donated, I can show you a pile. I'm actually collecting things, you know, from a couple of other climate groups that send me about a pound of mail a month, even when I don't want to be on their list. Done all those things, donated money, you know, bought the t-shirts, you know, begged them not to send me the backpack in the mail, don't want it, don't need it, just an unending stream of stuff. And what we realized is that those things haven't worked. So we've got 40 plus years of real big American full-on, you know, environmental movement, and it's failed. It's just failed. And the measure of that failure isn't the Paris Accord or the fact that America has left that, because that's a political decision we can't control at this point. But what the failure is that we as a civilization are accelerating our carbon output. We're accelerating our destruction of our forests. We are accelerating our industrial animal farms. We're accelerating all these things that are just causing more and more and more social and societal, environmental, ecological, and systemic collapses, both here in America and around the world. Those things have failed. So the one thing, as Adelaide said, that has proven to work is nonviolent direct action. And when you get, there's someone named Chenoweth, is her last name. Is it Erica Chenoweth? Is her first Erica? Erica Chenoweth has done massive research on all the different movements around the world that have been successful in this way. And basically, when you have approximately 2 to 3.5% of the public actively engaged in a social movement of this type, and 50%, and the second piece is 50% of the public supports you morally, then what happens is that there is a turning point and the country shifts. And so what we recognize is, if we're going to go, we don't believe in breaking windows and setting cars on fire and doing these violent protests, because that only turns the public against you. We create an environment where the grandmas come down with the kids. It's a, you know, it's a street festival kind of atmosphere almost. If you look at the videos, you can see what's going on. But also, we're very determined for those who want to volunteer, get trained to, and then sit down in the street, as it were, and become arrested. And that's because when you have enough bodies being arrested over and over and over again, it puts the government in a strategic dilemma. The more you show up and the more you get arrested, the more people want to show up and get arrested, and the more the government has to stop it. And so they get in this place where if they stop you, they're just giving you more publicity and more people show up. If they let you go, you get more publicity and more people show up. So eventually you overwhelm the government's capacity to resist the demands, and more of the public supports you. And you get the police out there, they may be in their truncheons and their battle gear, but when they have grandmas with kids and strollers, and they have old veterans in their uniforms and wheelchairs, and they have jugglers and music and festivals and food carts and people getting arrested in the street, it's like it puts them into a contradiction. They don't know what to do, and the people there that are getting arrested look like their family. And so eventually what happens, as you can see in the UK, is the police in the UK, for example, were actually apologizing for arresting the people who are doing the direct actions and sitting in the streets. So we have a huge proven track record historically of how this works. And we just have to get enough Americans understanding that we are in existential crisis, gonna collapse the planet, gonna starve to death, billions of people, war, famine, all the bad things that go with it. And that the time to act is now. There will be no better time. So I'll pass that across to someone else to keep going with that if you want.
Yeah, to go off of what Adelaide said, there are environmental movements and organizations, tons of them out there, and we, XR, Extinction Rebellion, prioritizes nonviolent direct action through the main way of doing it, and they have demands, they have wants, but the thing is, with XR America here, we have a national plan with a step-by-step way to, you know, get to those demands. And we're acting, our second demand is net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2025. And we are acting in accordance with that plan. We're trying to get a big event. We're building up for a big event now for about 1 million people, Washington, D.C., 50,000 of which would be arrestable, but 1 million people out in the streets by April 2021. So we're trying to build that momentum very quickly, and because net zero by 2025 is only less than 5 years away, so we need to act accordingly. And I think by acting accordingly, we can inspire other people as well to be like, oh yeah, they're serious about their demands. They have a rock solid plan. They're putting in the work to getting there. I want to get involved.
I just want to add real quick, having watched some very recent talks on this subject, the systems in place, such as NGOs and nonprofits, they work with the existing system, which is the problem. Nothing within the current system is able to act as quickly as we need for this problem to be mitigated in a way that avoids complete catastrophe. We're talking about nonviolent direct action now. If we don't do that, violent action is going to be inevitable. Once we see mass migrations and food shortages, there's no going back from that step. Mm-hmm. If you look at the climate science and the data, it becomes really scary. This is what has also motivated me to get even more involved with Extinction Rebellion most recently. The raw data that is coming from scientists and people within industry that are speaking out because the data is just so shocking now.
If you are just joining us, I'm talking with five people who are, in alphabetical order, Adelaide, Cameron, Donald, Isaac, and Jonathan. They are involved with Extinction Rebellion, an organization dedicated to mass mobilization for action on the planetary emergency of the climate crisis.
So I heard, I think, one of your demands. Could you list out, you said you had four demands?
Yeah. Yeah. Adelaide, you look like you wanted to speak to that.
Oh, I was just, I'm going to ask if I should pull them up and read them off.
Yes, please.
Sure.
All right. Our first demand is for the government and for the media, and that's to tell the truth. Government must work to tell the truth by declaring a climate and ecological emergency and working with other institutions to communicate the urgency for change. The second demand, act now, government must act to halt biodiversity loss and reduce greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by the year 2025. Number three, beyond politics, the government must create and be led by the decisions of a citizens' assembly on climate and ecological justice. And four, one people, one planet, one future, government must work for a net planetary zeroing of greenhouse gas emissions and planetary repair by the year 2030 on the basis of equity and mutual survival interest for all communities, countries, and generations. And I want to clarify, I've said the date 2025 and 2030. 2025 is our goal for the United States, and 2030 is our goal for the world in general.
Wow. Wow, that is really great. So we've got Portland and Seattle represented. If there's someone from Tacoma who wants to get involved at that level, how would they go about doing that?
Who of our mobilizers would like to speak to that?
Well, they can go to xramerica.org, and then I believe there's a link on there to join more directly. They could also get in contact with one of us. I'm here in Seattle, Adelaide's in Portland, where you're kind of right in between us. My email's donaldz@xramerica.org. Adelaide's is adelaide@xramerica.org. And then what we're doing is we're giving a bunch of Heading for Extinction and What to Do About It talks, tell us what the climate crisis is, what to do about it. And then also chapter formation meetings. These are tells you how we structure chapters, these chapters that we're trying to build the capacity to get to 1 million in DC by April 2021. And so you can come to those, check them out, and how to structure a chapter and form one as well if you're interested. Beyond that, there's also just general outreach. Try and find people in your area who would be interested in getting more involved. Cameron, Isaac, and I and others have been in the Seattle area doing roadblocks, kind of like 3 minute, give or take, sometimes more, sometimes less, roadblocks once a week to bring it out there, get the activists' feet wet, you know, practice for the big action, and get the message out there. Tell people that this is a serious issue. We are willing to do something out of the ordinary. We don't mean any inconvenience, but it's an emergency. We have to look at this. There's also, you know, general making flyers, writing up emails. There's lots of ways to get involved. Whatever you work best with, we can make it work. Building art, working on social media. But xramerica.org is the main website. You can get involved with them there, or you can send us a direct email.
Thank you.
Oh, you could also go to Facebook, Pacific Region XR America. Is that it, Donald? Yeah, Pacific Region XR America on Facebook, or just XR America on Facebook. Although it would probably be more efficient for you to just go to the Pacific Region page.
Yeah, and direct any questions to that page as well if you do.
So do you have any actions coming up?
So Seattle has been doing some actions for the last 2 weekends we did actions. So 2 weekends ago, we did 2 days in a row of actions last weekend. So a couple days ago, we did an action for about 4 or 5 hours. And so this next weekend, we're continuing that pattern of trying to increase slightly each time what we're comfortable doing. So not giving too many details away, but we're going to go around and see somewhere, block some more traffic in a new way that is a bit more higher stakes than what we've done before, most likely. from anywhere from a half dozen people up to a dozen people. More is always better, but it's been safe every time we've done it. We've had interesting results each time we've done it, and but it's been very heartening to see the people's reactions and people's growing confidence and people coming and saying, like, well, we're really glad to see someone's actually doing something and not just talking. We want to come do it with you. And that's really the goal of it, is to show people that we're not just talking about it. We're going to be on the street until we get as many people we need to do the big action come later. Because if we don't do the building now by actually being in the streets right now, people won't take us seriously.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, all of this should have been done 50 years ago.
Yeah.
It drives me bonkers.
Well, it's. I think the basis for that is twofold, really. The first is that systems are designed to be optimized and to run at a certain level, right? And so our Western civilization is designed around a capitalistic, consumeristic, extractive basis on the planet, right? And you know, the old saying that people often banter around is, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins. And so there's this sense of infinite growth possibilities, right? That was a big transformational book for me, was to read The Limits to Growth from the Club of Rome, like 35 years ago, and maybe 40. But the bottom line is that the systems are designed to self-replicate and self-maintain. That's why our political system is so unresponsive to this existential crisis. We immediately dumped $1.5 trillion into the stock market for fear that the market wouldn't be stable, but we've got something that's going to collapse human civilization that half of our government is in denial about. Not just denial, but actively suppressing it. And so, you know, the average person in Seattle or Portland or wherever across the country, you know, is trying to deal with COVID-19 crisis and the economy. And maybe they've got kids in school, and their kids are supposed to go to soccer, or they've got to figure out how they're going to retire, or their parents are sick, or all these day-to-day things. And the human brain is designed for short-term problem, solution, and response. We don't deal with things 40, 50 years down the road, which is why we've kicked the ball down the road, right, as a civilization. There are many of us who've been alarmed, but there's also been a concerted effort. Let's be clear. There's been a concerted effort to suppress information about the climate problems, about the problems of what we're doing with our forests, about what we're doing with industrial agriculture and industrial animal husbandry. These things are just, if you look at them individually, they're each horrific in the way they've been dealt with, right? And if you look at them collectively, what you're seeing is you begin to see this pattern of what we call overshoot. And we are now in civilizational overshoot on the planet. And there's this feeling that it can just go on forever, right? And we're really dancing while the Titanic is sinking. And so we are in a radical, horrific, existential crisis of systemic collapse all the way across the board on the environment, on our planet. And people are more concerned about not being able to get out a haircut or go to a bar. And so the reason why nonviolent direct action and the disruption that the actions are doing is to get attention to people, to kind of wake them out of this consensus reality trance that we as a society are in, right? Let's face it. I think the number one game that every child has played in America is Monopoly, right? How many winners are there in Monopoly? Always. One. What happens to all the rest? They're screwed. And that's what's happening with our economic system. We're in the final stages of that consumption and destruction, much to the deficit of every other living thing on the planet, every animal. I mean, we're killing billions of animals. We're wiping out whole forests, ecosystems. And now we're at that point of near collapse. We're going to crash the car, if you will. The question is, are we going to crash at 120 and kill everyone in the car and everything around us? Or are we going to crash at maybe 45 and break a few legs? That might not be a great analogy, but maybe someone else has a better analogy or can share their thoughts on that.
I get the analogy. Yeah, I think it's pretty good. Adelaide, though, what you were going to mention an action that you had?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're trying to have these done kind of all over the country, as many places as possible on the 4th of July. And the history major in me is going to come through again. When Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott held the Seneca Falls Women's Convention in 1848, I believe it was. It was either 1847 or 1848. They wrote the Declaration of Independence, just a little bit, to suit their purposes. Every man and woman is created equal. So we have also rewritten the Declaration of Independence just a little bit to suit our purposes. And we're trying to get as many people to as many state capitals, or if that's not possible, into as many city capitals on July 4th to read out this declaration of rebellion, to really kind of usher in a new era of activism. That sounded very, very puritanical, but I stand by it.
Could you send me a copy of that? Because I'd like to read that on the radio.
Definitely.
Yeah, I would like to say, you know, in addition to all the things that I mentioned that you can do to get involved, we have like 8 methods of mobilization, which, you know, we recommend if people want to get involved with that. There's a heading for Extinction Talk. They're online. We have mobilizers giving them live. Attending any of those would be great. And if you want to be trained to give that, we can hook you up with the people who can give that training. There's rebel ringing, making phone calls, basically phone banking. Specifically with rebel ringing, that tends to be more people who are already expressed interest. But also you can do phone banking on your own, just to people you know. There's also house meetings, to the extent which this is safe given COVID. You can either have a Zoom house meeting or a house meeting where everyone meets, as long as everyone's safe. Door knocking. There's a group in Seattle here, Tax Amazon Action Group, and they have been doing in-person outreach, and so they're taking precautions, trying to be safe. So one thing they're doing is they leave a flyer, knock on the door. They're wearing masks and gloves, and then they step back 10 feet. And if the people want to talk about their issue, they'll talk. If they don't, they're like, thank you for your time, and they move on. So that's one way to get door knocking done while COVID is still here. Same thing, well, with tabling, set up tables, stand, give out flyers, park events, etc. Talk about the issue. Again, wear mask, wear gloves, probably have hand sanitizer, and offer people literature. If people touch something, they should probably take it. There's fly posting, put up like flower paste, use that to fix some signs up in different places where it might be seen, or you can use stickers, I suppose. That might be a little bit civil disobediency already, but getting like a region, getting like any city covered in like 200 or 2,000 stickers, that people are going to notice. And that's what Opport did. And I think their uprising against I forget the guy's name, but Opport was pretty influential and pretty effective at what they did in getting a despotic leader overturned. There's social media outreach, reach out to everyone you know online on Facebook, Twitter, etc. And then we do publicity events as well. And then, you know, in actions are outreach as well. And doing those, promoting them afterwards, talking with people we engage with during. And yeah, those are like just some suggested ways to do outreach. And you don't need a bunch of people at once right now. Like, say you're just yourself, and you can go out and do things. And as I said, actions are outreach, and that can draw in more people. You know, the more the merrier, of course. Yeah. Never turn people away unless they're for some reason a detriment to the movement. But a lot of people want to help.
So there's a lot of ways that people can plug into this. Mm-hmm. Just depending on where they are and how much energy and time they have.
That's right.
Definitely.
So it's we all need to do something.
I'd like to suggest that when people consider doing something, that they start with an exercise. So get a piece of paper and a pencil or whatever, or maybe open up your laptop and start out with the idea of, you know, write these three things down. First is that, it's the best estimate of scientists that we can no longer maintain our civilization the way it's running once we get past 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial temperature, right? The second is, once we get above 2 degrees Celsius, it's unlikely we can maintain our agricultural systems. And once we get above 3 degrees Celsius, it's pretty certain it'll be impossible to maintain anything similar to what our modern life looks like, even with the most heroic of efforts. So if you write those three numbers down, 1.5, that's what the IPCC says is we have to stay below. And the 2.0, that's considered the, you know, I don't know if you can I swear, it's the oh crap moment, right? It's the oh crap, we're doomed. And then at 3.0 and above, it's the Mad Max kind of like hell on earth kind of thing. Yeah, it's baked in, right? So let's take those three numbers, let's write those down. Now let's start adding up where we are. Where we are is a minimum of 1.1, according to the IPCC, but that only goes back to 1850, not to 1750, which is where the Industrial Revolution and the deforestation started. If you really look at the number that the scientists outside the IPCC use, they say we're at 1.3 right now. Mm. So we're really close to 1.5 according to that. But then there's a couple of things that aren't talked about or aren't added into the calculation with the IPCC because they're a political body. They're not a scientific body. And so what they do is they take on the bell curve of information from things that are absolutely clearly known by everyone and agreed upon. And then you bell curve that up and you go back down to the cutting edge science with the modeling and everything else that's going on. They take that middle of the bell curve, shift it to the conservative side, and then they have to get every single government agency that's involved with the IPCC to agree. So it's wildly conservative and typically about a decade to 15 years behind the best science, not the cutting edge, but the best science agreed upon. And what we're seeing right now is that there's a couple of things that aren't being taken into account. One is what's called global dimming. Global dimming is where you burn fossil fuels like coal and diesel and so forth, and the particulates and the aerosols that they put out into the air prevent sunlight from coming down to an extent and prevent heating. So it's an artificial coolant. But we have to get rid of fossil fuels if we're going to survive. So we're going to stop those. And when we stop those, we're going to get an extra minimum half a point of heating. So now you've got your 1.3 and you just added half a point. That should make you break out into a cold sweat and make you not sleep at night. But then you've got to add in something called the CO2 heat lag. So the carbon dioxide heat lag. And that heat lag is about 10 to 15 years. In other words, if we take some CO2, we throw it up into the atmosphere today from our city bus or a car, it's going to take about 10 to 15 years to reach its optimal heating, its maximum heating. Right? Like it takes water time to boil on the stove, it takes CO2 time to heat up in the atmosphere. We've got another half a point baked in already. If we stopped cold turkey today, all fossil fuels, we've already got a half a point. If we keep going to 2030, even with some downgrade, we've got a full point. So now our 1.8 is at 2.8. That should terrify people. That should make mothers worry about their small children. Will they live? And then you add in a series of other things that we won't go into technically, but you've got the frozen methane that's in the Arctic shelf underwater. And that's been covered by ice for all these tens of thousands of years, millions of years actually. And as we lose the ice up there in the Arctic during summertime, there's a feedback loop where there's less reflection off that ice and the sun goes directly into the water and heats that up. Well, the methane is now bubbling up on the Arctic shelf underwater. And that's probably about a half a point in the next 10 to 15 years, if not a full point by 2050. So now we're well past three. And there's another three or four things that we can talk about, like forest degradation. Look at Australia, they lost 20% of their forests. We're losing forests in the Amazon. We're losing forests in all through Southeast Asia. We're losing forests in the Congo and Africa. That's another half a point. And you can keep going. So what we're facing is, we are an imminent self-destruction, civilizational, and planetary ecocide and suicide. That's why it's like, we can't just write letters. We can't just petition. This is all hand on deck. The house is on fire. We don't have time to argue about anything else. There is no other thing that's more important than this. It's even more important than COVID-19. Hard to say, but to hear that perhaps, and I grieve deeply for people that have been lost. And if we don't put all hands on deck for this, we spent $1.5 trillion on the stock market in the first day we did something, another couple of trillion for corporations and businesses after, and we can't get our government to acknowledge there's a crisis.
So maddening. It really makes me want to just go to a government, one of course governments are meeting again, to go to a government meeting and say, okay, so you guys haven't been able to decide on anything for 60 years, and now suddenly there's a pandemic, and look, miraculously you can get along, so why haven't you been getting along about this other extreme crisis?
And one action that can be done is doing that. That's not something that I've seen lately, but that is a tactic that can be used, is going to meetings and being like, hey, I'm going to be the loud voice in the room no one likes right now, but I'm going to shout out the truth that everyone needs to hear.
History major once again. In, I believe it was 1913, Alice Paul was attending a speech given by Woodrow Wilson about some sort of tax thing, and she unfurled a banner in this room that said, Mr. President, what will you do for women's suffrage? That's when public meetings are safe again. That is a great tactic, Mr. Governor, Madam Governor, what will you do about climate change? Perfect way to completely derail any conversation and turn it to what you want them to talk about.
Yeah, and I should add, most Americans more Americans are disgusted or angry about climate change than they are feeling hopeless about it. So that's a good thing. That means they're primed for action. But there is a section of people who are feeling hopeless about it. And when you listen to the possibilities and where we might be heading, especially as J-Lo mentioned, there is that real possibility that it it might be too late, but my understanding of the science is general consensus is most likely, from the recent science, most likely outcome is 3 degrees Celsius, which is still horrible, as mentioned. But the worst case scenario is more likely worse than we thought it would be. And so in like 2015, I think Martin Weitzman and Gernot Wagner, I think, came up with, they had a 10%, they assumed a 10% chance of 5 degrees Celsius or more, which is, and Martin didn't think humans could survive at past that level. So there are not significant non-zero chances of that extinction happening. We reduce them the more we do now. There is suffering at the moment, like today in lots of the world, because of we haven't done enough. There's going to be more. We can't avoid that. But we can set a cap at where that suffering will be. What's the max amount of suffering we're going to have? And that depends on what we do. And we've seen throughout history, you need to be disruptive. You need to do, nonviolent civil disobedience to get the attention of the public and the lawmakers.
We are the only species in the history of Earth that has been able to understand its own imminent extinction. And we are the only species that has had the capability to halt its own imminent extinction. And there's no question, we do have the capability. It would be, if everybody were in agreement, it would be relatively easy to halt our own extinction. The trouble comes from everybody not being in agreement. The question isn't can we, the question is will we? Another thing kind of similar to Jonathan's analogy about the car crash, I always say there's something you don't want to buy, but you have to buy it. You don't have a choice. You have to buy it. You can buy it now and you can pay $700 for it, or you can wait for a few years and you can pay $7,000 for it. Take your choice, because either way you're going to end up paying.
And something that keeps me from becoming hopeless about our situation is thinking that even if, despite everything we try to do, humanity doesn't survive, every single action we take now will still reduce the suffering of every other species on the planet and give them a better chance of survival as well.
Including humans too, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it to me, in some sense, it comes down to conscience. Every religion in the world, every spiritual tradition, every humanist tradition has an essence of conscience and of, the precautionary principle. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. First do no harm. There are all these things that humanity historically has really held as anchors to who we are and what we believe. And now we're kind of in a time of uncharted, rapid transformation and growth. And the question is, will we step up and bend the curve, like we've tried to bend the curve on COVID-19, are we going to bend the curve on climate? And the question is, are we willing to do the hard things now so we don't suffer the terrible things later quite so much? And not just about us, because, you know, the global south, they didn't create this. Almost 90% of all this comes from the global north and the industrialized and the first world nations, as they've been called. And really the people in the developing countries in the global south, they're really just as much victims of this as everything on the planet that's alive. You know, they're really just depending on us, our fellow human beings, our fellow species on the planet. Every living thing is depending upon what we do to change our behaviors. And in essence, to grow up as a planet, to recognize that we are one planet, that we are one, you know, one living organism, Gaia, if you will, from my own perspective. But we are just one beautiful planet, and we control whether it dies or lives. And that's a deep moral charge to all of us.
I must say, I believe that the name of the organization is riveting. I mean, Extinction Rebellion, it says it all. I really, really like that. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap this up?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, everybody's going to find themselves around the climate conversation in a different space. And it's a lot like the levels of grieving, right? The stages of grieving, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then finally acceptance. And so we welcome everybody at whatever stage they're in, right? The fact of the matter is, if you're a wheat farmer from, you know, a third generation wheat farmer from Eastern Washington, or you're come from a lumber family out on the Oregon coast, or, you know, fishermen from Port Orford, or whether you're a computer programmer in Seattle, or you're a soccer mom in Bellevue, or you're a woman business owner in Eugene, Oregon, it doesn't matter. We are all in this together. And there is no politics when it comes to saving the planet. The only politics is saving the planet. And the science is clear. The problem, the great tragedy in front of us, the epic existential threat is in front of us, and it will affect all of us equally. So it's time for us to come together, put any differences aside, and let's go get the job done.
I don't think so. Oh, I think we should each say our emails again, just in case.
Yes.
My name's Adelaide. I'm in Portland, Oregon. And you can reach me at Adelaide, Adelaide, at xramerica.org.
And I'm Donald Zepeda, DONALDZ, at xramerica.org.
Well, this has been really, really good. Thank you all. And I don't know, just to wrap up, I encourage everybody to go to xramerica.org and find out more and get involved.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
I'm talking with five people who are, in alphabetical order, Adelaide, Cameron, Donald, Isaac, and Jonathan. They are involved with Extinction Rebellion, an organization dedicated to mass mobilization for action on the planetary emergency of the climate crisis. If you are interested in becoming involved, you can visit their website, xramerica.org. There, you can read the Rebel Handbook, sign up for emails, and find out about events. Anyone ready to start a Tacoma chapter? Again, that is xramerica.org. Thank you.